I want to concentrate particularly as we begin on one word, and that is the word therefore. Now, that it doesn't only appear in this place in Romans, but I want you to see that it's a transitional word. It's part of the structure that Paul is using. In fact, it's part of a familiar sense we have. Remember, all of the 11 chapters before this have been wrestling with ideas in some ways. We're going to come back to that. And then in this verse, we see a turn to how then should I live? What should you do because of all these 11 chapters that precede? Well, I want us to think about the structure of Romans, this very familiar structure, and let it help us understand the sense, the purpose, the lesson, the meaning of this whole book. You understand that what Paul does here is what he also does in Ephesians. Remember, that sixth chapter book is nicely divided. First three chapters, big ideas. The last three, more practical. Again, that's not a perfect division, but it's a familiar and commonly noted characteristic. Well, I want you to know that I don't think we're just talking about Paul's tendency. We're not talking just about his habit of mind, though surely the Holy Spirit, by inspiration, is using Paul's tendencies. But it's not just that. Paul doesn't simply say, as a rhetorical choice, I think I'll start with big ideas and then go practical. I want you to see that this therefore, this bridging word, helps us to bridge our understanding of this whole book. It is a book that hinges on therefore. I've got some ideas, and now I'm going to live. We need to walk forth from this building this morning having refreshed in our minds some of the ideas that will enable us to live abundantly outside these doors. So let's keep this structural feature of Romans kind of in the fore of our minds as we try to think about what's going on here. But there's not just this structural device. There are more. And so I turn you now to a second structural feature, a little play that Paul repeatedly makes. I think as many as 10 times. In fact, there are a couple of others that are like this. And so let's go to chapter 6 and verse 2, and we'll see an instance there, one of these several times. Starting with the first verse of chapter 6, what shall we say then? A question. Are we to continue in sin that grace may abound? By no means. So this emphatic declaration by Paul, by no means, is part of his structure. He repeats it 10 times. It has to be consciously intended. It's not just an accidental eruption in one moment. No, this is an intentional structure. And you see what's happening in each case. Look in this case. Well, having learned that God's in the business of forgiving, wouldn't it be a good idea to sin as much as we can so he can forgive as much? We're helping God be God. We're helping him do what he does. So let's sin. By no means, says Paul. Do you understand? So Paul sets up this way of thinking that's outrageous. And then he cuts it off. By no means. What are you thinking? So you see what he's doing. He's doing what 12:2 says. Don't be conformed to the world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Do you see what Paul is doing when he says, by no means? Stop your thinking here. And if he repeats it 10 times or so, then he's giving all these attempts to shape our thinking. Let's go on down in chapter 6, verse 15. What then? See, there's a question again, just like in verse 1. Are we to sin because we're not under law but under grace? By no means. You see, now it's a new argument. Now he's saying, does this grace cover whatever I do? All right. Is it a license? Go ahead, grace. And by the way, I think that's one that's pretty tempting in our time. But Paul's answer is the same as it was in verse 2. By no means. So here again, Paul frames it so that one's thinking could race off in a direction, and Paul cuts it off. By no means. Don't think that way. Don't imagine, don't assume that you could take this understanding and push it to an absolute. That's wrong thinking. So I'm going to structure the way I write this letter. I'm going to structure by giving a big set of ideas, and then we're going to turn to practice. I'm also going to structure this letter by addressing very likely troubles and telling you to shut it down. Don't even think that way. You see, Paul is in the business of shaping our thinking here. And so when we pay attention to what he's doing in these 11 chapters, we're ready when he says in verse 2, don't be conformed to the world. Don't let those ways of thinking lead you. Be transformed by the renewing of your mind. So here we have a second structural device which Paul is using to help us understand what his book is about. He knows this is a big one. He knows this is a challenging set of ideas he's addressing, and so he's giving us some helps along the way. We're going to continue seeing some more of those. By the way, take care, take comfort. There are 5 bullets in this, and we'll be done. Now, there are some distractions along the way, but there are only 5, so you can manage this. The next item I want to turn to is more of the main idea of the book in some ways. I'm going to suggest that if one could be so bold as to suggest they've got the main idea of Romans. But I want to go to a phrase that's used more than once, and it is the phrase, the righteousness of God. And of course, righteousness appears in other ways in the book as well. But let's go to chapter 1 where we see it first. Famous, again, I'm going to some of the most familiar passages in Romans, and inviting you to think about what in the world is this writer attempting for us to see. When I look in verse 16 first, I'm not ashamed of the gospel. For it is the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. For in it the righteousness of God is revealed from faith for faith. A puzzling phrase. As it is written, the righteous shall live by faith. You understand, I think in some ways Romans is about the righteousness of God. Now, what does that mean? And that's where we're going to digress now. I've got another slide that's got other bullets on it that's just an elaboration of this one. Because I want you to think about the righteousness of God for a minute. And I think in one sense, if we're not careful, we've done too good a job of, by no means, we've done too good a job of hemming in our thinking about the righteousness of God. We've done a too good a job of saying, well, that's just part of God's nature. Well, certainly it is. But what does it mean? What does it mean to acknowledge the righteousness of God? In fact, I'll suggest to you, as Paul does in another letter, some of you may remember the very last verse of chapter 5 in 2 Corinthians. He says that we may become the righteousness of God. The people he's writing to in Corinth, the people reading his letter who claim to be disciples of Jesus, have the potential. They can become the righteousness of God. What in the world does that mean? And so here's what I want you to think with me. I want you to understand that the righteousness of God is not something, not a mere possession. It's not a quality. It's not a condition that one possesses, that God possesses. What is the righteousness of God? I've gone ahead and just put all the bullets up there at once, but these are just different ways that I've chosen to word it. I'm not even sure I'm right, but there are plenty of people who will correct me if I'm wrong. But I think what I want to do is see what righteousness means. And so I give you this array, God's faithfulness to his promise and to his declared will. That's what Romans 1:17 sounds like. In the gospel, God is fulfilling his faithfulness. And that's what we see. But it's not just an event. It is an entire order. It is entire, it's a cosmic order. It is a world. It is God's enacted nature. It is God's practice of his justice and mercy. It is God's faithfulness to his covenant. Now you can read all of those, and the variations may not be very great, but I'm simply trying to get you a chance to think about different ways that we might understand this. But I hope you'll notice that the last, third and fourth particularly, have this active quality to them. It's not enough to claim it as a possession. God doesn't simply possess a nature, he enacts a nature. And that's something that we might want to consider. If we're going to be God's people, we might enact something and not merely think we can possess it. One of the ways that this occurs to me, that I can wrestle with this and help you, I think about games that we might play, especially, let me mention several kinds of games. When you play Candyland, I don't even know if that's still around. Come on now, somebody remember. When you play Candyland, you've got to get out the board and you set it up. And when you play Monopoly, it's great fun. You set up the board and you get all the little houses together and you stack the money and come on, you set it up. Right? And even at Hogwarts, whatever that game was they played, you've got to set it up. And people here that I know there are at least seven who play video games, that when you open up a game, you see the world inside that game and you try to figure out how it works. But you also know this, you don't get to figure it out just by looking at it, and you didn't get the game just to look. You don't set up Monopoly and just say, man, isn't this a nice setup? You set it up so you can play the game. And we can go to other games, even more mythical than Hogwarts. Kyle Field. Do you understand? People go to there. You see there, and they're, what a setup, right? They're just an elaborate array of things all over, including those water coolers and just everything. And cheerleaders on one side, yell leaders, depending on which side of the field we're talking about. But there's an elaborate setup. And people who like going to the games, when they sit down, they say, ooh, this feels right. And this year, some who went to such games even might say, it feels righter because it's not so crowded. But still, you see, there is a setup. But nobody sets up for football and then just looks around. Wow, this is what it's supposed to look like. Yes, you do that. Because you want that feeling, this looks right, but then you want the game to happen. Ladies and gentlemen, God's righteousness is his setup. This is what he wants to happen. And he enacts it. He doesn't wait. He doesn't just say, I've done it. No, this is a lived experience, right? Let me take you to the verse that probably has generated more thought in my mind the last decade than any other, Jeremiah 9:24, right? Let him who boast in this, that he knows me and understands me, that I am the God who practices steadfast love and justice and mercy in the earth. See, I don't practice this in some abstract. No, I practice these in the earth. And doesn't even stop there. In these things I delight, declares the Lord. That's Jeremiah 9:24. Look it up. Chew on it a while. You see, God saying, I live this out. It's not just a condition. Right? I have a condition. Well, we might say that. Well, I have a faith condition. Well, please, keep this in mind. So the righteousness of God, Paul uses that phrase. He uses it right there in that center, that central claim early on. This, what is the... In the gospel, the righteousness of God is revealed, right? That's revelation talk. Let's go back. Back to another. This is more of a structural device. The phrase obedience of faith. It's three words. How can they be a structural device? Well, by no means is structural, I believe, because it's repeated so many times. Create, each time it's used, it's a shield to shut something off. Don't think that way. by no means is only a part of me. The obedience of faith is used twice. But where it's used is so intentional. It cannot be an accident. It's not just an incidental eruption. Words start flowing and out it comes. No. The Holy Spirit working through the mind of Paul creates a bracket. There's even a fancy word for these kinds of things, but we don't need it. We just understand bookends. Here, look at this. Right there. Verse 5. We just barely got started. And Paul says, I'm working to bring about the obedience of faith. That's what I'm trying to do. And then in the very last chapter, not the last verse, but pretty close to the very end, the same phrase comes back. Do you understand? We've got bookends, ladies and gentlemen, bookends where Paul says, this is what I'm doing. This is my goal. And so if you don't remember anything else this morning, I'd recommend you take these three words and chew on them. What does it mean? And I hope you see what it means is that this is our version, or this is our participation in the righteousness of God. God is acting out his nature. He doesn't just possess a nature, he lives a nature. He enacts a nature. And we as his children, as we sang, as adopted children, in that lovely song that Reed led this morning, Abba Father, in that song, we are adopted. And because we're adopted, we get to participate in his righteousness. It was revealed, and we get to join in that. And what that means is we get to live that world. We don't just set up the game, we play the game. And it's the game of our lives. And when we do that, look at this. We are obeying. Obedience may not resonate with a lot of people in our time. It's not this religion business. This Jesus business is about love. Well, it certainly is that. But here, Paul says, I am about the business of the obedience of faith. I have a faith that compels me, moves me to obey. And you see, think about this. I want to suggest to you that the structure of Romans is caught in these three words. The first 11 chapters are really exploring faith in lots of ways and shaping it by no means, building a frame around our thinking. And then chapter 12 has got lots of obeying in it. Chapter 13 and 14, lots of obeying. So do you understand that this purposeful structure of the book is the lesson of the book? The lesson is, I'm here to invite you into the faith of Jesus, but faith is not something you have merely. What does Romans 1 say? Look at it. I'm back at Romans 1, 17. For in it the righteousness of God, our phrase, is revealed from faith for faith, as it is written, the righteous shall live by faith, right? It does not say the righteous will have faith. See, that's those who are caught up in a transactional notion that would say, all I need to do is have that one moment of getting right with Jesus. The deal is done, made my deal, it's all settled. Have not read Romans 1. It's not enough to have faith. We are pushed to the obedience of faith. We are invited to live by faith. Again, let me make it explicit here. No claim to earning anything by this. We simply live what we have. Right, we play the game. We play our lives. I told you there were 5 bullets. I know you're counting. Let me take you to another verse. This is back in Romans 16 that does a little bit of bridging for us to our last point. But in chapter 6, verse 17, I picked the verse because the word obedient comes in here once more. But notice it doesn't say obedience of faith. Let's see what it says. Here we go. But thanks be to God that you who were once slaves of sin have become obedient, listen to this, obedient from the heart to the standard of teaching to which you were committed. You see, there it is again. Obedience is there, but it's never mere obedience. See, that mere obedience gets dismissed as kind of mechanical, rote, kind of insignificant. Well, the obedience isn't thrown out. Obedience is there, but it's obedience, look at that, obedience from the heart. Can you have that kind of obedience this morning? Can you go forth from here with this, a sense of an abundance before me? I have the opportunity that God has set up his justice and mercy, both there working together. How they work together, I don't know perfectly, but they do. And he's laid out his world, and he's invited me into his world and said, I want you to join me and live as if you think what I've laid out works. I want you to live as if this works. Thanks be to God. Let's go to the last word. Present. It's not present. Present. Right? Context alone tells us. But I want to show it where it appears twice. And so in this way, I'm going back to the verse we started with. You see the second reference comes from chapter 12. But this first reference is just before what I've just read to you. All right, by the way, not only is the present just before the verse I've just read, it's just after the by no means I read. So I'm going to back up and look in verse 6:15. What then? Are we to sin because we are not under law but under grace? By no means. There it is. Don't imagine. Don't let your mind run away. Bring it back under control. Controlled by this language of by the righteousness of God. Do you not know? Here it is. Do you not know that if you present yourselves to anyone as obedient slaves, you are slaves of the one whom you obey, either of sin, which leads to death, or of obedience, which leads to righteousness. So you will present yourself. That's the word he's using. One way or another, you are going to present. And our little school had prom this weekend. I didn't go. I have no idea what happened. And you cannot imagine how glad I am that that's true. But for some people involved, don't you know there was a big dealing going on? Because there were people who wanted to be very careful to present themselves. Think about it. Think about a bride on her wedding day wanting to present herself. You are going to present yourself. It's inescapable. It is inevitable. You will present. The only question is, how will you present? To whom will, to what in this verse, to what will you present yourself? You see, this is, if Paul only used this word once, then maybe we could say it was just an eruption, just a notion that came as he was being led along by the Holy Spirit. But I hope you've understood. I hope you've learned from the preachers we have here that there's not an idle word. And so I want to go to another place. Let's go back to where we started. Let's go to Romans 12 again in verse 1. I appeal to you, therefore. Therefore, because you've read about the righteousness of God, because you've been cautioned repeatedly, by no means, to understand that what we're talking about is the obedience of faith, faith rightly understood, rightly lived, I appeal to you by the mercies of God. See, this is God. This is the God who, in laying out his world, lays out justice and mercy. And here, the appeal is to his mercy. By the mercies of God, look at this, to present. There's our word again, present your bodies. And notice this. look how we're to present. As a living sacrifice. Do you see the difference? This is not, as said about Jesus in Hebrews, once for all. Now, Paul says about Jesus, his death brought justification, but his life brings salvation. Think about that. Right? We focus on his death, on his burial, on his resurrection, and we should. But the story doesn't end there. Paul says it's his life going on after that will save us. And for us, we have a transaction. But here we're told it doesn't stop. It's a living sacrifice. It goes on. It goes on. Continuing sacrifice. What an astonishing picture that we get to carry forth with us, that we have this potential, we have this possibility of several things here. One, that I have the chance before the Lord of the universe to present myself. That in itself is astonishing, but that's the cosmos, that is the world that God has set up. We get to present ourselves to him if we'll only choose to do so, if we'll only enact the obedience of faith, if we'll only live by faith, if we'll only be obedient from the heart to the teaching that we've received. So there's no mystery, nothing new in what I've said this morning, but I hope to give you a sense of, at least a little bit of a sense of this, the central focus, it seems to me, of this big, demanding book called Romans. Let's close this morning by thinking simply about this. You are a presenter. And right now, this morning, how are you presenting yourself to God? I'm assuming that at least many among us have already presented ourselves before God as a helpless sinner. And we confess Jesus as Lord and say, I want to turn from sin and walk and be baptized for the remission of sin, arise to walk in newness of life, language out of Romans. And I want to live this covenant relationship. And maybe you got to go back and think, am I a living sacrifice? Have I extended that commitment on day to day to day? Maybe for many of us, but that's our question. Are we living the sacrifice? Are we presenting ourselves as such today? But there may be somebody who this morning wants to present themselves before God for the first time and say, yes, I understand this world of justice and mercy. Both are there. And I don't know how all of it fits together, but I know that you have created this world and that through Jesus, the revealing of that possibility is here, and through him I can be adopted. Through him I can become your child, and that's what I want. So this morning, each of us has an opportunity and a responsibility, I believe, to consider our presentation. If there's someone who'd like to present themselves this morning for the group's loving support, I hope you'll do that right now as we stand and as we sing.